content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Well, hello there, and welcome to the February 2014 edition of Heard Any Good Books Lately? A program from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This monthly program is brought to you by the Friends of the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, an organization of citizens, volunteers, and patrons, all interested in supporting the library and the services it provides. The Friends Group was founded in 1989 and now has more than 300 members across North Carolina. If you would like to join the Friends Group yourself, we'll have information on how to do that later in the program. Well, this program is all about books, with special emphasis on those available from the North Carolina Library for the Blind. The library has more than 86,000 titles in its collection. That's right. Books and magazines are available in large print, braille, and talking books as well, both digital and a few cassettes still available. And the library has more than 11,000 patrons across the state. If you are not a patron but are interested in becoming one, I'll have more information at the end of the program here about that as well. This month we have a special treat for you. We're going to take a look at some of the books that have been produced locally by the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. Now, many of the books available as digital books were produced by the National Library Service, but quite a few are produced and read right here in North Carolina. So we'll hear some of those today. First, we will talk about a few books that were right up there in the top 10 most popular books during the month of January, our first month of 2014. We begin with a book entitled The Chance by Karen Kingsbury, a very popular author. Number one New York Times best-selling author Karen Kingsbury proves it's never too late for love in this heartwarming story about childhood friends, broken lives, and an age-old promise. Years ago, the day before Ellie moved from Georgia to California, she and her best friend Nolan sat beneath the Spanish moss of an ancient oak tree and wrote letters to each other, sealing them in a rusty old metal box. The plan was to return 11 years later and read them in 2013, the year Nolan's time-traveling books say all the mysteries of the world will be understood. Now, as that date approaches, much has changed. Ellie, bereft of the faith she grew up with, is a single mom living in a tired apartment and trying to make ends meet. Nolan, now an NBA star, has dealt with terrible personal tragedies that fueled his faith and athletic drive as well in equal measure. Ever since his father and coach succumbed to a heart attack, Nolan has suffered from a transcendent loneliness. Drowning in an ocean of grief, he often thinks about Ellie and the innocence of their childhood days together. As Ellie and Nolan move toward the possibility of a reunion at the oak tree, Molly and Ryan, the central characters from author Karen Kingsbury's previous novel, The Bridge, return in their own ongoing story. Written by the queen of Christian fiction with eloquence and grace, The Chance is a beautiful tale of heart-wrenching loss, the power of faith, and the wounds that only love can heal. That book is called The Chance by Karen Kingsbury. It was the most popular book at the North Carolina Library for the Blind in January. Now, another consistently popular author, Danielle Steele. Her book that was so popular this past month was called Friends Forever. Here's the plot. Five children meet on the first day of kindergarten. In the years that follow, they become friends, and more than friends. Together, they will find strength, meet challenges, face life's adventures, endure loss, face stark realities, and open their hearts. In this moving novel, number one New York Times best-selling author Danielle Steele traces their unforgettable journey, full of tests and trials, as three boys and two girls discover the vital bonds that will last a lifetime. Friends forever, Gabby, Billy, Izzy, Andy, and Sean, each bursting with their own personality, strikingly different looks and talents in sports, science, and the arts, each drawn by the magical spark of connection that happens to the young. At the exclusive Atwood School on a bright September day, starting in kindergarten, they become an inseparable group known to outsiders as the Big Five. In this rarefied world, five families grow closer, and five children bloom beside one another, unaware of the storms gathering around them. As they turn from grade schoolers to teenagers, seemingly perfect lives are buffeted by unraveling families, unfortunate missteps, and losses and victories, both great and small. And one by one, they turn back to the Big Five to regain their footing and their steady course. But as they emerge from Atwood and enter the college years, the way forward is neither safe nor clear. As their lives separate and diverge, the challenges and risks become greater, the losses sharper, and the right paths harder to choose in a journey of friendship, survival, and love. In what may be her most intricate and emotionally powerful novel yet, Danielle Steele tells a heart-wrenching, ultimately triumphant story that spans decades, weaves together a vivid cast of characters, and captures the challenges that we face in life, sometimes, if we're lucky, with the friend forever by our side. Very popular book this past month, Friends Forever by Diane Steele. Now we'll continue with another popular book during the month of January. It was called The Shell Game. It's the Professor Simon Shaw Murder Mysteries, and it's actually book number 5 in that series by Sarah R. Schaber. Here's the plot. Professor Simon Shaw, Pulitzer Prize winner and sometime sleuth, encounters his oldest corpse yet, Uwari Man, who died 14,000 years ago on the banks of Baden Lake in North Carolina. But Uwari Man isn't the murder victim in Simon's latest case. That victim is Simon's closest friend, archaeologist David Morgan. Simon is convinced that David died because he came between factions struggling for control of Uwari Man's bones, the Lumbee Indian Nation, who want to rebury the skeleton, and the archaeologists who want to study and display it. Tension escalates as the Lumbee insist that Uwari Man is Native American, while the archaeologists suspect he was Caucasian and push for the opportunity to investigate further. Simon's colleague in detection, Police Sergeant Otis Gates, disagrees with Simon's theory about David's death, straining their friendship to its limits and leaving Simon to hunt for the killer alone. Adding to Simon's burdens, he has been chosen to be the executor of David's will and must deal with Morgan's difficult sister, who is Gates' primary suspect. Throughout, Simon single-mindedly pursues his friend's killer, whose identity shocks everyone. Simon, most of all. Shell Game is Schaber's best entry yet in a solid and always delightful academic cozy series. The book was called Shell Game. It was one of the Professor Simon Shaw Murder Mysteries, number 5, in fact. And that was one of the most popular books at the North Carolina Library for the Blind during January. Now, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, we have a few books here that were read locally, read by people here in North Carolina. And the first one is a book review of a book that was written by Philip Shaw Paladin. It's called Victim: A True Story of the Civil War. It was published by the University of Tennessee Press in Knoxville. And it's an older book. It was published back in 1981. But it sounds like a good one. This, of course, is nonfiction. Here's the plot. In a remote Appalachian town called Shelton Laurel, North Carolina, 13 Unionist mountaineers were murdered by the Confederate Army in January 1863. The Shelton Laurel Massacre and the associated guerrilla warfare in the Appalachians were small and oft ignored events in the American Civil War. Paladin's rationale for studying these conflicts was that they gave him the chance to tie the social history of the Civil War to the Civil War era, to a concern about the relationship between the grand events that are the focus of most historical investigation and the daily experience of ordinary life. Now, despite the small scale of this event, much of Paladin's evidence on the people involved comes from varied primary sources such as memoirs, oral family histories, census data, newspaper articles, court cases, as well as private and government letters. The emerging history is uniquely human, both engaging and troubling at the same time. Rural mountaineers, despite living in the Confederate state of North Carolina, generally favored the Union because of class hostility, rural suspicions of more urban places, and a feeling that the wealthy and influential slave owners were threatening hard-working common people. They fought with guerrilla-style hit-and-run tactics due to the rugged terrain around Shelton Laurel. Locals had a saying that in these mountains, a person could shoot a squirrel 50 feet away and have to walk a mile to fetch it. The largest drawback of using guerrilla tactics was Unionist mountaineers would not be treated as regular enemy soldiers on the battlefield. When a regular soldier surrendered, rules of engagement required that he be captured and treated respectfully as a prisoner of war. Guerrillas could be killed when surrendering. If captured, they were taken to a local civilian court to stand trial for their crimes. On the Confederate side, Paladin introduced readers to Lieutenant Colonel James Keith, Colonel Lawrence Allen, and General Henry Heath. Keith and Allen lived in the wealthy town of Marshall, located in Madison County, where Shelton Laurel also was located. Both men already were wealthy and successful when the Civil War began in 1861. They saw an opportunity for added respect and glory when they volunteered to serve as officers in the 64 North Carolina Regiment. Due to the availability of Henry Heath's detailed memoirs, Paladin spends a large portion of the book, at least 25 of the 144 pages, detailing his life. Great things were expected of Heath, yet he fell short. At West Point, Heath had poor grades and found his status in the class of 1847 by becoming its outstanding prankster and general incorrigible. Heath's military career bounced him from Mexico in 1848 to Fort Atkinson, Kansas in 1851, and then on to Utah in 1858. All the while, he became more and more frustrated that he missed out on major action. He was praised for keeping a cool head in tense situations, though, and eventually was promoted to brigadier general. Future defeats in western North Carolina in 1862 and later in Kentucky caused Heath to be passed over for promotion to Major General. He then was unhappily transferred to command the East Tennessee region overseeing the 64th and other regiments. In Chapter 4, The Killing, Paladin realizes one of his stated goals in the preface is to appeal to informed hearts and minds by writing actively and emotively, causing the reader to concurrently empathize with the victims and the murderers. 50 mountaineers raided Marshall, North Carolina for salt, clothing, and money needed for Unionists and Confederate deserters hiding in the Appalachian Mountains. Colonel Allen lost two of his three children from scarlet fever during the aftermath of that raid. Shelton Laurel families suffered greatly when Allen and Keith, after receiving orders from General Heath, brought the 64th Regiment to find the Unionist band of raiders. During questioning, many women were tied to trees, whipped, beaten, and hung to nearly the point of death. Livestock was slaughtered. Homes and barns were burned to the ground. Allen and Keith were frustrated because they only captured 15 men, and two later escaped and were repeatedly fired upon by Unionist guerrillas. They marched their captives to Knoxville for trial. A few miles on their way, Keith ordered five of the prisoners to kneel, and they were summarily shot by the Confederate soldiers. The rest were treated the same way until all were dead. David Shelton, the youngest at age 13, is attributed with unsuccessfully pleading, "You have killed my old father and my three brothers. You have shot me in both arms. I forgive you all this. I can get well. Let me go home to my mother and sisters." Paladin wraps up the event in a fifth chapter and an epilogue. The war continued, and other big events such as the Battle of Gettysburg, the overall demise of the Confederacy, and Reconstruction overshadowed the small and seemingly insignificant Shelton Laurel massacre. Lieutenant Colonel Keith was the only officer to be indicted and stand trial. He evaded judgment on 13 individual counts of murder by escaping prison. Colonel Allen eventually resigned and wrote a pamphlet detailing his career with the 64th. General Heath eventually was promoted to Major General and served under General Lee, a close friend since West Point. His military career turned for the worse when his poor decision-making contributed to defeats at Chancellorsville, Gettysburg, and the Battle of the Wilderness. The surviving people of Shelton Laurel mourned their dead, regrouped, and continued to abide in their isolated Appalachian wilderness homes. Paladin's history on guerrilla warfare in the Appalachian Mountains during the Civil War and the Shelton Laurel Massacre is a well-written and engrossing book. It causes the reader to ask questions that can be applied to many wartime atrocities, such as the Holocaust of World War II or the My Lai Massacre in 1968. The reviewer recommends this book to any thoughtful student of history. And that was one that was read locally here in North Carolina. And again, the book is called Victims, A True Story of the Civil War by the University of Tennessee Press. It was written by Philip Shaw Paladin. That sounded like a pretty exciting book, actually. Although it was nonfiction, I think you might enjoy that one. Now, while we're on the subject of the Civil War, let's look at another book. Now, this is a fictional book, and it takes place in the post-Civil War era. It's written by Wayne Caldwell, and it actually was his first novel. It's called Cataloochee. Against the breathtaking backdrop of Appalachia comes a rich, multi-layered post-Civil War saga of three generations of families, their dreams, their downfalls, and their faith. Cataloochee, the name of the book, is a slice of Southern Americana told in the classic tradition of Flannery O'Connor and William Faulkner. Pretty high praise there, I would say. Nestled in the mountains of North Carolina sits Cataloochee. In a time when where you was born was where God wanted you, the Wrights and the Carters, both farming families, travel to the valley to escape the rapid growth of neighboring towns and to have a few hundred acres all to themselves. But progress eventually winds its way to Cataloochee, too, and year after year the population swells as more people come to the valley to stake their fortune. Never one to pass on opportunity, Ezra Banks, an ambitious young man seeking some land of his own, arrives in Cataloochee in the 1880s. His first order of business is to marry a Carter girl, Hannah, the daughter of the valley's largest landowner. From there, Ezra's brood grows, as do those of the Carters and the Wrights. With hard work and determination, the burgeoning community transforms wilderness into home to be passed on through the generations. But the idyll is not to last. nor to be inherited. The government takes steps to relocate folks to make room for the Great Smoky Mountain National Park. And tragedy will touch one of the clans in a single, unimaginable act. Wayne Caldwell brings to life the community's historic struggles and close kinships over a span of six decades. Full of humor, darkness, beauty, and wisdom, Cataloochee is a classic novel of place and family. That was a popular one, and that was written by Wayne Caldwell. It was his first novel called Cataloochee. And now, because that sounded like such a good one, there was another one that's very popular as well, his second novel called Requiem by Fire. In this one, Wayne Caldwell returns to the same fertile Appalachian ground that provided the setting for his first novel, recalling a singular time in American history when the greater good may not have been best for everyone. Now, in the late 1920s, Cataloochee, North Carolina, a settlement tucked deep in the Great Smoky Mountains, is home to nearly 1,100 souls, many of them prosperous farmers whose ancestors broke the first furrows a century earlier. Now, Oliver Babcock, Jr. has been given the difficult task of presenting the locals with two options: sell their land to the federal government for the creation of a national park, or remain behind at their own financial peril. While some of the area's inhabitants seem ready to embrace a new and modern life, others, deeply embedded in their rural ways, are resistant. Silas Wright's cantankerous unwillingness to sell or to follow the new rules leads to some knotty and often amusing predicaments. Jim Hawkins, hired by the Parks Commission, has relocated his reluctant wife Nell and their children to Cataloochee. But Nell's unhappiness forces Jim to make a dire choice between his roots and his family. And a sinister force is at work in the form of the deranged Willie McPeters, who threatens those who have decided to stay put. Requiem by Fire is a moving, timeless tale of survival and change with humor and pathos. This magnificent novel transports readers to another time and place and celebrates the Southern storytelling at its finest. And by the way, Requiem by Fire, by Wayne Caldwell, was the winner of the 2010 Thomas Wolfe Memorial Literary Award from the Western North Carolina Historical Association. That was a good one, and I think you would enjoy that one. Now, let's listen to the plot of a book by Margaret Graham. It's called Good Heavens, and it's part of the Esmeralda series, which has been very popular at the North Carolina Library for the Blind. Here's the plot now. Esmeralda is a feisty, southern, small-town widow who takes care of herself, her neighbors, and her friends. And she likes her life just the way it is. Thank you very much. But when a halfway house for female addicts finds itself in need of a responsible woman to move in and help out, against her better judgment, Esmeralda volunteers. Now, she knows nothing about drugs or about much of anything else these women have been through, but she knows when she's being led. So she packs up her life, moves to the mountains, and becomes a house mother. Now, there she meets women with lives she could never imagine, and she must navigate well outside her comfort zone. On top of this, the center's fast-talking, well-educated director just won't give the homespun ways and wisdom of Esmeralda a chance. Will Esmeralda be able to learn how to truly love the unloved and sometimes unlovable residents of the house? Or is it time to give up and move back home? Praise for Margaret Graham's writing. Graham knows the South, church folks, and older women, all the makings for an authentic slice of modern small-town Southern life. The state newspaper in Columbia, South Carolina, Esmeralda's sweetness and sass will charm the socks off readers. Graham's plot is picture perfect and peppered with hoots and hee-haws amid sobering situations. Her characters entertain their foibles and educate with homespun charm. And that is a book called Good Heavens, part of the Esmeralda series that you may have listened to before. And it was by very popular author Margaret Graham. Now, as I mentioned, we're reading about a couple of books that were produced locally here at the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, and one of them here is a book called Holy Smoke, The Big Book of North Carolina Barbecue by John Shelton Reed and Dale Volberg Reed, along with William McKinney. And this particular book, if you get a copy of it, was read by John Stein. North Carolina is home to the longest continuous barbecue tradition on the North American mainland. Who doesn't know that, right? Authoritative, spirited, and opinionated in the best way, Holy Smoke is a passionate exploration of the lore, recipes, traditions, and people who have helped shape North Carolina's signature slow food dish. Of three barbecue devotees, John Shelton Reed, Dale Volberg Reed, and William McKinney, trace the origins of North Carolina Q and the emergence of the heated rivalry between Eastern and Piedmont styles. And that is quite a rivalry, as you know. They provide detailed instructions for cooking barbecue at home, along with recipes for the traditional array of side dishes that should accompany it. The final section of the book presents some of the people who cook barbecue for a living, recording firsthand what experts say about the past and future of North Carolina barbecue. It is filled with historic and contemporary photographs showing centuries of North Carolina's barbiculture, as the authors call it. Holy Smoke is one of a kind, offering a comprehensive exploration of the Tar Heel barbecue tradition. That's available now at the North Carolina Library for the Blind. And that book, Holy Smoke, was written by John Shelton Reed and Dale Volberg Reed, along with William McKinney. And the book was read locally here at the Library for the Blind by John Stein. I think that you will really enjoy that one. And there are a couple of other books that are new at the North Carolina State Library for the Blind. Don't have time to go into detail, but I'll mention them to you because I think they're interesting. The Highland Scots of North Carolina, 1732 to 1776. It's by Duane Gilbert Meyer. This is a book that examines the causes of the Scottish migration to Cape Fear, North Carolina, and their loyalty to the crown during the American Revolution. Sounds good. And The Last Rose of Summer, a novel by Teresa Coquelin. A woman grows up in a poor but stable environment in Depression-era North Carolina, but her life takes a turn for the worse when her brothers leave the family farm and her mother dies. And one day she kills her drunken, abusive father and is sent to Dorothea Dix Hospital. During her years at Dix, she comes to understand herself and other people, and upon release finds her way to love and a more normal life. That one is called The Last Rose of Summer by Teresa Coquelin. The first one I mentioned, The Highland Scots of North Carolina by Duane Gilbert Meyer. And that's all the time we have for this month's edition of Heard Any Good Books Lately? I'm George Douglas. Hope you enjoyed it. If you'd like more information about how to become a patron of the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, simply Google or search for North Carolina Library for the Blind. Or you can call toll-free at 1-888-388-2460. That's 1-888-388-2460. You can also use the same numbers and website to join the Friends of the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. It is that wonderful organization that sponsors this monthly feature on books. This program is intended for a print and visually handicapped audience. Heard Any Good Books Lately will be available right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.